All right, welcome to the Pat Life Podcast. As always, I am Patrick, and again with me today is James Maganot. How are you, dude?
I'm doing well.
Dude, well, as I said, I got tons of questions. First and foremost, how's the farm?
It's busy. It's the beginning of the season, which is awesome. We love the different seasons, and it's a real busy time of the year. So we got a lot going on.
Awesome. So we're going to dive into all the ins and outs of what you have going on in regards to preparing. But I do want to talk to you, as we've been obviously chatting text and email about just the big storm that came through. I think it's important for people to understand just kind of what devastation not only does to people in their homes, but when you have livestock, a farm, and everything else in between, just kind of what that whole experience was for you.
Yeah, it was a historic storm for much of the country, and we were no different here in Northwest Arkansas. We saw negative 30 degrees air temperature, negative 45 wind chills, wow. Something people that have lived in this part of the state have never, ever seen in their entire life. We had about, a foot of snow, which something that a lot of people don't know about snow. Snow is actually a good thing for livestock. It acts as an insulator. So for those of you that are in the right parts of the country and you see snow on cows' backs, oftentimes people think, oh, they're cold, you know, they've got snow on them. In fact, snow on the back of a cow shows that it's keeping its body heat in and that it's well insulated. So yeah, definitely historic. We struggled through it. Lots of water issues. You know, water is such an important factor. When you talk about cattle, is really the combo that we're looking for. And when you cut out any one of those key ingredients, it becomes real challenging. So we had some water issues. There were a lot of busting ponds happening around here. And just making sure that they had plenty of fresh water. The other key component is feed and making sure that they had plenty of hay. So a cow's body temperature is roughly about 102 degrees, and cows have four different stomachs. So when they are eating a lot of roughage, a lot of hay, they actually can get their body temperature up multiple degrees. And so another key component in weather extremes is to make sure they have plenty to eat. So it was a full-time job pretty much around the clock. We also start calving about the first week of February. And so when this storm hit the second week of February, over a week span, when it got really cold, we had 9 calves, which is awesome. We lost 2 of those calves. We tend to have a very hands-off approach to calving. You know, we kind of let nature take its course and do its thing. But there are certain times when we need to step in and do something. Mm-hmm. We were doing a lot of that week, bringing calves into the house, warming them up, getting them dried off, and then getting them right back out to mom so mom can do her thing. So, yeah, it was a tremendously busy week, learning experience. You know, may or may not be something we ever see again in our lifetime here, but definitely a learning experience.
Hey, man. And so would you say then that with the water issue kind of being one of those big things that of all the different pieces that you felt like it was like, oh, man, we have to scramble comparatively?
Yes. So farmers all around this region were scrambling left and right on water issues. One of the problems with ponds, while they're great and they're an active water source, is they do freeze over. And what happens when it freezes over is cattle get worried and go looking for water, which means they venture out onto the pond. So I spoke with a number of cattle producers around here that lost animals, either full grown animals or calves, because they wandered out onto the ice and fell in. In fact, one of the farmers county below us lost his life because he was trying to get a cow out and he went under.
Oh, no.
So ice is a real, real dangerous predicament on a farm. Yeah, I mean, everyone we were talking to was struggling with the same issues we were. There's quite a bit of camaraderie amongst farmers when it comes to weather extremes and things like that. So, you know, we all pulled through it with our different tricks and methods. And I can't say that I know of any farm around here that didn't have water issues. And I certainly don't know any farmers around here that didn't lose some sort of livestock.
Yeah, it. Man. Well, this goes back to our first conversation in regards to, you know, as a consumer, you're getting the food, you're getting all these different products, produce going, oh yeah, you know, I about me, my health. But as we said, well, a big component is the farmers in the livestock and what's going on in the farm and their well-being, because as you said, obviously, the, you know, it's tragic that that gentleman passed away. But at the same time, it's like, as much as yes, a lot of people I understand we're going through hardships and there's no denying that, it's still a matter of as this, you know, the smoke clears, people are still looking for food. So they're still looking to be, want to be able to go to the farmer's markets and get that fresh produce. You know, so as much as yes, that obviously understandably, but it's also important to know what are you guys going through? What is, how are you? Are you okay? Is your, you know, is your farm okay? You know?
Yeah. Weather plays such an important role in raising food, right? Mm-hmm. But this weather event, weather extremes are really the equalizer among food producers and people consuming food, because everybody has to deal with the weather extreme, right? So farmers have to deal with it on their end of things, but everyday consumers have to deal with it on their end of things too. And and as you said, I mean, there was quite a bit of tragedy in Texas down below us with people losing their lives and stuff because they didn't have access to basic necessities.
Yeah, but well, I'm just glad to hear though, you know, that you guys made it through and you're now in your spring season, man. You're going full gun here. So just kind of tell us a little bit about what that experience has been like, what people can expect as we kind of segue into the other conversations.
Absolutely. So I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't say it all revolved around weather. So just like we were talking about, everything in every season, but especially in the spring, is revolving around weather. So in terms of the animals, you know, so much of what we do is making sure that that soil is living, right? Mm-hmm. That soil life is thriving and living and doing well. And if you've got ample animals trampling over that soil constantly nonstop as it's thawing and freezing and raining and drying, it doesn't have a chance to live. And so part of what we have to do is show some restraint this time of year. And instead of just gung-ho going after it, you know, there's green grass out there, we have to hold back a bit and say, give the grass a chance. Give that leaf coverage on that forage a chance to capture that sunlight. And so we have to show some restraint. So we do have grass out there right now, and we are very much limiting the cows and the chickens onto that grass right now to give it a chance to create that solar canopy to harvest that solar energy. On the vegetable front, everything this time of year is about soil temperature, right? So it can be 75, 80 degrees outside, but if that soil temperature is still down in the 40s, nothing's going to germinate, right? Mm. And so something we've moved to, not exclusively, but a large percentage, is raised beds. And one of the reasons we grow in raised beds, amongst other reasons of weed control and things like that, is we get a jump on our spring season because that soil temperature gets a little bit warmer a little bit quicker. Mm. And just getting that soil temperature up gives us the opportunity to germinate things that would otherwise just sit there and lay dormant until the soil got warm enough.
Now, do you guys, I've seen other farmers, they've put like heat wires that run through the soil in the raised beds. Do you guys do stuff like that to help
run? We don't do that method, but we do have a number of our raised beds are made out of cinder blocks. So I will scour old construction sites and stuff for cheap or free cinder blocks. And the reason I do that is the cinder block itself captures that solar energy too, right? And it holds heat. So I actually use the cinder blocks that are forming my bed to capture the heat, warm the soil. So that's one method in which we try and, you know, take advantage of that amazing sun that we've got and get the soil temperature up quick.
Interesting. Nice. And then, so yeah, I know you also have greenhouses that you use. So just describing to people what those are being used for and at this time.
Yeah. So we've got a hoop house, which is a passively solar heated growing mechanism. It's it's 20 foot wide by 100 feet long, and that's in full production right now. So we have beets, carrots, kales, spinach, lettuce, radishes, turnips, all being produced and harvested right now. We planted them back in January, and we're in full harvest right now. Hoop House gives us roughly a 60-day beginning of our season, and it also gives us about 60 days on the other end of the season, extending it out. So it's a season extension mechanism that allows us to grow beyond what we're just growing outside.
That's awesome. And so you're also in the raised beds starting to do a lot of the same vegetables and stuff?
We try and do things in succession. So that we have a diverse table each week at the market. You know, if you plant all your spinach at once, it's all going to be ready at once. And so we plant a little bit of spinach every 2 to 3 weeks. We plant a little bit of radishes every 2 to 3 weeks so that we have a succession when it's ready to come out.
Gotcha. So what is it that you guys have in the raised beds right now?
Onions. We planted 1,000 onions. Potatoes just went in the ground. So 300 or 400 pounds of potatoes, garlic. You can plant garlic in the fall or the spring. We didn't get to it last fall, so it went in springtime. But a lot of that stuff we get in the ground now in hopes of getting a crop and getting it out by mid-June. So it's a lot of planning. It's a lot of planning and rotating to make sure that you're getting things in and getting them out at the right time so that you can get your summer crops in.
Now with the potatoes, just kind of staying on this point here for a sec, do you guys just take old potatoes and just like cut the ends off and dry them and do that? Or how do you guys do the potatoes?
You can definitely do that. For the scale that we're doing it at, I would need to have a lot of potatoes to be able to do that. So we actually buy organic seed stock, local co-op, but a lot of people do that and can do that. One of the simple things I always remember about potatoes is get them in the ground by the St. Patrick's Day and get them out of the ground by 4th of July. So it's a real simple, you know, same every year time frame for potatoes, for Irish potatoes.
Now, what do you think that is? I have no idea.
I think it probably stems from the Farmer's Almanac a long, long time ago. Is people plant according to different schedules and cycles. According to the moon cycle is a very, very common thing. It's something that we loosely follow, not to a T, but loosely follow it. But just common cycles that people, easy things for people to remember in your backyard garden.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm aware that in reality, the start of the new year is technically March, if you're actually following the technical. And then for those who don't believe me, just look at Latin, count to 10.
Yep.
So, you know what I mean? That's pretty, you know, Decem is December, you know, and November is the 9th. It's
how many things in our society and in our culture, if you go back to their roots, their roots are based in agricultural community. I mean, you know, daylight savings time, right? That was exclusively done for farmers. Voting, we just got done with elections and stuff. Voting was always done on a certain day so that the farmers could be in town and make it to town and go and vote while they were there. So, there's all sorts of things that are embedded in our society that relate back to agriculture.
Totally. Well, is one of the gentlemen that I follow, I don't know if you ever heard of him, his name's Crow, Triple Set. It's a guy who has a podcast. He basically says that everything goes back to the sky clock, the sun, the stars, you said the moon, the zodiac. When you really understand its importance on a grand scale, but I'll digress on that because that could be a whole nother conversation. But
we talk a long time about that, and there's lots of different things that we do on our farm around those cycles because
let's dive in. Let's dive in. If you want to talk to, let's get the gravy here. I love it.
So one of the big ones is weaning, which means taking the baby cow away from its mom. We do something called fence line weaning, which means that the mom and the baby are never really removed from each other. They always can touch their noses together and feel safe and secure, but we separate them out so that that calf can grow up to be a cow and that the mom can dry up and take care of her own body condition. But we do that according to the moon cycles to limit the stress. So low stress animal handling is a big thing and making sure that those animals are not stressed because when they're stressed, not only are they not putting on weight and gaining weight, which has a financial impact, but they're also, there's been some studies now that actual the food itself, the meat itself, is not as healthy for you if there's a lot of cortisol and other things in the meat itself because of the stress of the animal. And so we do that according to the moon cycles. And you, I'm putting myself on the spot here. I'm pretty sure you do it on the waning of the moon, not the waxing of the moon. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was something that was just taught to me a long time ago. And is there truth to it? Yeah, there's definitely truth to it. And anybody that gets their hands dirty every day and is connected to the soil life and the life of biology going on a food production model can tell you that, yeah, there's truth. There's truth to a lot of that stuff.
Well, I mean, it goes back to, you know, kind of going down this rabbit hole a little bit, is when you understand that we are an electric system that we're currently in, this place that we live in, it really is an electric system. Everything's electricity, right? You know, solar, wind, all these things is moving from parts of electricity. Yes, it's thermal. Yes, it's other components as well. It's pressures, etc. But when you look at going down now to biology of like, all right, the sun is an electric force. It's an electric stimulus. It's giving obviously that power to your plants, to your soil, to your animals, all these things. And as you said, if you have an animal that's stressed or food that's stressed, what is that doing on an electric level, right? We as individuals and people, we have electric charge in us too, right? What's a sodium? It's a negative charge. What is a potassium? It's a positive charge. Now, what happens when there's an imbalance there, right? Like you said, with the animals, or even just you overstress your plants.
Yeah. Now, well, it's something that a lot of people don't have a connection to anymore. You know, we've talked about that extensively, about how people don't have connection to their food and how it's grown and where it's from. And I had had an eye-opening moment. She went to the eye doctor this week, just like, you know, millions of Americans do every single day. And she had a deficiency of a certain mineral. And that doctor said, you know, make sure that you're eating your leafy greens, you know, your kales, your spinach, things like that, to get that mineral up in your body. But one of the most awesome things that he said that you really don't hear about from a lot of conventional medicine practitioners around here is he said, truthfully, if you can find it local or you can find it fresh, that's the best way to do it, because the stuff at the grocery store does not have the nutrition in it that you think it might have in it, because it was harvested early. It was not done in sync with these natural cycles, and it sat on a grocery shelf for however long before you went and purchased it. And it was so awesome to hear a medical professional understand that on that level, that food in the grocery store compared to something you're buying at a farmer's market or buying fresh, it's not the same.
Right.
It has different components to it, has different energy to it. Mm-hmm. And the more people can understand that, most especially our medical professionals, I think the better off we'll all be as a society, that we start understanding that not all food is created equal.
Dude, it's such a good moment for not just you and your wife, but just as you said, like that doctor as well, the impact that that's causing on so many people that he may be speaking to, right? Because most of us are deficient in something. Just goes without saying. I mean, I saw some studies that like the majority of the population is deficient in magnesium. Magnesium is a huge one. You know what I mean? And there's a bunch of them, right? But it just goes to show you, it's like, well, if I'm eating foods that, you know, I look into, I research, say they're high in magnesium, but it, you know, I don't know where it came from. I don't know what the processing was. It just becomes a matter of now going, well, how much of this am I actually getting? Is it obtainable when I'm consuming it? Right. Is it, what's the word I'm looking for? Like available.
Right.
So it just starts to really dawn on me when I'm looking into all these different pieces and wanting to hear more from farming. As you said, everything goes with farming to nature, to the cycles, to all these different components, and really connecting you not just with your food, but the place you live, you know, because that's right there for me is the most fascinating thing. Is there anything you want to add before I go too far?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, you talk about connecting to your food and where you live. So everything reverts back to the sun and the soil, right? The sun is that energy. It is that battery of life. Mm-hmm. And transferring all this energy to these different things, animals, people, plants, but without the soil in the right space to be doing what it does, I mean, neither I nor many of the experts out there truly even understand all that is going on in our soil. Oh, yeah. All of the microbiology and all of the interactions and the chemical changes, it's a world all of its own. And the more we can understand that our health and our food are a direct result and direct product of what's going on underneath the ground, the better off we'll all be.
Well, it goes to show you, because I've been just super fascinated with just trying to understand history. And when you look at different, tribes and, indigenous populations, and you hear the stories or you read about the stories of them doing, like, for example, like the Native American, Indians doing rain dances and or like tribal ceremonies for the harvest, for the springs, for, the dying of the sun and then the resurrection. Obviously we know all that story, but it is interesting when you see all these different places that's like, oh, we're so far advanced from there. It's like, but are we?
We're so far removed from there, but not necessarily advanced. I mean, right. Communities that are connected to and live amongst the natural cycles, amongst the different seasons, amongst those things, have a greater connection to it. We're so removed from it, we don't have any connection to it. One of the things I was going to say to you earlier when we were talking about different deficiencies and people having different deficiencies, oftentimes you can listen to your body. And when I say listen to your body oftentimes, your body is one of the most amazing mechanisms on the planet, right? Yeah. And your body will actually tell you what you're deficient in. If you're craving eggs, there's something in those eggs that your body's telling you, I'm missing this, give this to me. Yeah. Now, it has been very, very skewed with high fructose corn syrup and a lot of other things that we put in our bodies now that have tried to mess up and whack up those bodies telling us this is what you need. But inherently, if you can get back to it, your body will tell you what you're out on.
Oh yeah. I was going to say that's the one thing that I experienced with my job is the, in the physical aspect, our inability to connect with body, like we're mind, body, spirit, that's how I see it. A lot of people can maybe disagree, but that's fine. But so many of us in the world we live in that I've experienced with clients is everything's in the mind, right? It becomes, all right, I need a problem solve. All right, I have this deadline. I have this, I have that. Everything's mind, solution based here. So then when you get somebody in the body, they have this resiliency that just kind of lives up here. But when you put them in their body, a lot of times it's like, oh man, I can't get sick. Let me just take this. Oh man, my back's on fire. Like I have a lot of clients who just they would like want to take a painkiller. And I'm like, your body's telling you something. It's this disconnect with body. And then when you put them under like a stress with the physical body, they don't know their body. They go into this whole panic, but you know what I mean? It just becomes this total disconnect with the body. So when you have deficiencies, completely ignoring it or not knowing that your body's actually speaking to you.
Well, and ultimately we as humans look for that one problem and that one solution, right? And this is true with our bodies as it is with agriculture, is we have broken things down to single source that we forget how interconnected things are.
Yep.
And at your back hurting, yes, your back is hurting for a reason, but it's connected to something else too. But instead we just focus on the back, right? Totally. Fix the back, give me a one-off, a solution, a problem-solving mechanism to fix the back. Right. But what about the whole? Right. And same is true with agriculture, whether it's using pesticides or herbicides, they're trying to solve one problem. Oh, if I could just get rid of this one pest.
Yep.
And so by applying something as thought to be a solution, we forget about the interconnectedness of the rest of the parts.
Well, it goes back to, I don't know if you've ever seen that t-shirt. There's a t-shirt, and I don't know the whole thing, but it basically is like, you know, I went to the doctor because I couldn't sleep. They gave me this medicine. So then it just shows you how, like, the adding on of all the medications and being like, by the end of it, this shirt basically says it's like, I still have sleeping issues, like, you know, but it is interesting.
Just drink some water.
Yeah, right, exactly. But it is interesting to me of how we kind of allow ourselves, a lot of us, to kind of put that in someone else's hands and be like, all right, something's wrong, fix it. Instead of, as you said, just simply trying to sit with body, sit with self and go, okay, what am I missing? What is not here? As you said, what am I craving? What sounds good right now? Why? Little things like that, you know?
Well, and really looking at your food sources as your medicine, you know, that's something that we've moved away from as a society as well. As you go back to some of those communities, some of those indigenous peoples that are so relative and related to the natural world, is your medicine. Your medicine is not ibuprofen out of a bottle. Your medicine is turmeric root. Your medicine is ginger. Your medicine is these different plants that do different things to our bodies. And that is such a lost knowledge base and such a lost art, even.
Oh, absolutely.
That if people could take the time to understand that their food really can be their medicine, people would be a lot healthier, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm with you 100%. And I think it kind of gears into even more why, you know, just chatting with you today was because just through everything that I've been looking into and just talking to more people, there is definitely an increase of people who are finding interest in talking to local farmers, trying to get to know where their food comes from a little bit better. So with that, and this is something that I was experiencing, hence earlier conversations, was, okay, well, now I know I want to do this. So what am I looking for? What are the questions that I should ask? Kind of basically figuring out, you know, how to take things in my own hand and do due diligence. So with all that being said, my big question to you, kind of maybe breaking into pieces, is I'm a new customer, or I'm someone looking for a local farmer. What are questions that you get from people like myself when they're coming to your farm or at the farmer's market? What are some of the big questions they'll start to immediately ask you? And we can kind of dive more into it from there.
Yeah, so you can start, and I try to start the conversation on a really broad scale, and then you can narrow it into very, very minute and complicated details. But the two big things when it comes to organic agriculture is, what do you do about pests and what do you do about weeds? And so those are probably the two biggest questions I get as it pertains to our vegetable production, for sure, is what do you do about pests and what do you do about weeds? And really just asking generic questions, not getting into, do you use herbicides? Do you use pesticides? Do you use Roundup? Those are all very pointed questions. But if you keep things broad and let the farmer, the person producing the food, talk to you about it, you can figure out pretty quick which direction they go in. And so we explain the different methods and different techniques we use specifically to pests and weeds. Truth be told, a weed is really just a plant that's out of place in our mind's eye. You know, that plant is not out of place in its mind's eye or in the larger scheme or cycle of life, but it's in the way, or it's in the wrong place, or it's in the bed, or it's in the row in our mind's eye. So as it pertains to weeds, we try and take a look at, okay, let's take out this anthropomorphic outlook on this plant and try and figure out, what is it doing? Oftentimes, lots of weeds have really deep tap roots, which weeds are actually doing a really good deed for us as farmers, is that they're pulling nutrients, they're pulling minerals from deep down into that soil, and they're pulling it up so that it's accessible to my spinach, to my tomatoes, to my lettuce. And so as much as we can, we try and leave the weeds. We let them be for the most part. The one weed that we do try and remove is Bermuda grass. Bermuda grass is a bane to gardeners across the country because it just creates a carpet over everything. And when you create a carpet over everything, your sunlight can't get in, your water infiltration isn't as good, and it can just choke stuff out. But for the most part, we try and leave weeds as they are. The little weeding we do is all manual by hand, with hose, things like that. So we don't use any chemicals. We don't use any other things other than, you know, our own two hands. But we really try and work with the weeds as opposed to fight them. Anytime you're raising food and you're trying to fight something, you're going to lose. you just don't fight Mother Nature. Right. And that sounds so cliche or whatever, but Mother Nature's going to win. Right. And so we do our best to work with her as opposed to fighting her. As it pertains to pests, pests can be attracted to different things. So we will actually plant certain crops or certain flowers sometimes solely to attract those pests. One example is dandelions. We actually plant dandelions, which many people might see as a weed in their yard, right? But they attract, pardon me? Yeah, absolutely. You can eat dandelion greens. They're actually very tasty.
Do you eat the whole thing?
We eat the greens, not the flower, not the yellow flower itself, but just them. Yeah, just the leafy greens, all the leaves you can pick off and put in a salad and eat raw. Okay. Marigolds are another thing that we plant at the end of each rose because they attract certain insects that then pulls them away from your tomatoes or your eggplants or whatever. We also do a pretty intensive crop rotation, meaning we don't plant the same thing in the same place. So we were planting potatoes here last week, and we made sure that we planted potatoes this year, we haven't planted those in the past 4 or 5 years in that spot, because moving things keeps pests away, right? So many pests live in the soil. And if you keep planting the same thing over and over and over again, those pests just sit there and wait for you to plant it.
Yeah.
You're just providing a food support. But if you can rotate things through, certain bugs are a pest to tomatoes, but they're not a pest to spinach or vice versa. So crop rotation is really important.
So with that, like, was it like a 4 or 5 year period where you'll see the best yield in regards to dealing with pests?
Yeah. So one of the best things I ever heard from an organic farmer 15 years ago when we were starting out was, if you're going to farm organically in the mid South, plant 3 times as much as you want to get, because you're going to lose a third of it to weather, whether it be a freak hail storm or drought or whatever. You're going to lose a third of it to pests, bugs, different things, because you are doing things organically, right? And then you'll harvest a third of it. And that kind of, whatever you want to call it, has held true for us. You plant 3 times, and as we plan, we plant 3 times as much as we actually plan on harvesting and selling. And by doing that, not only can you plan, but again, it's working with Mother Nature and recognizing and realizing and saying, yeah, we're going to lose 2/3 of this. And that's okay, because it's part of a larger cycle. It's part of a larger whole picture of what's going on. And when you lose something, sure, you might lose a third of a crop of tomatoes. It might, you know, they might not make it to that farmer's market table, but maybe that plant is doing something for the microbiology in the soil. Yeah. Maybe that plant is going into a compost heap that then gets returned to that soil. So there really isn't truly in a holistic closed system cycle, you're not losing anything.
Well, it goes back to what we were saying about the sun, the moon, you know, kind of just the celestial, you know, rotation or zodiac, whatever you want to call it, in regards to that being in a system. Everything has purpose. Even if something seems off, there's reasons for it. Like you're just talking about, even the cold front that came through, as tragic as it is, there's reasons, right? If it really is a natural process and that's just how it was, you know, what's coming from it, right? And I think what it is everything's a test and then a lesson learned, rather than,
all right. And it's a cycle. I mean, while we struggled through that week and it was a tough week for a lot of farmers around here, we all collectively said the tick and mosquito populations this year are going to be drastically cut back. Why? Because they got killed off that week. And that's all part of the natural cycle of things. And ultimately, you, me, spinach, chickens, cows, we all go back to the earth, right? We're all a bunch of minerals,
carbon
and sunlight and carbon. Yeah. And we all go back to the earth. We all end up back in the ground one way or another.
Yeah. And I think that's the big, one of the big takeaways for me is just learning, is really understanding that when it seems like it's at its hardest, or as you said, you're losing all this crop, understanding when it's in a system and you're feeding the system and you're trying to treat it well, your body, it's going to yield positive results in the end. It might not seem like it in the moment, but it's going to give you a positive yield when you allow yourself to take the step back, see the bigger picture. And again, it's about taking care of it, right? If you're not taking care of your soil, if you're not taking care of your animals or yourself, then yes. But if you're through a journey, you're like, wow, this is challenging. This is really hard. It feels like I'm actually going backwards. It's like, just you're on the path. That is a path.
And farmers are in it for the long game. I mean, a lot of the things and the what I will call crutches that are out there in the petrochemical world right now, whether it's a pesticide or Miracle-Gro or things like that, they're all crutches to try and achieve ends right now. There's no consideration to the long run, to the long game. And that's something that anybody that's in food production and agriculture is in. You're in the long game. You're not in it for this cycle or this season or this growing period or this market calendar year. You're in it for the long game. So that's something that we always come back to here is, yeah, that was a rough week. And, we're having a wet week now. But in the long run, what are we doing? Are we bettering that soil? Are we bettering the land on which we're producing this food? And if at the end of the day, we can say, yes, we are doing that, then we're doing something good.
Yeah, man. Well, it's, I was going to say, I think when you take a minute and seeing how many people you have loyal to your co-op and buying from you guys, knowing very well all the things that you do to create that, positive, an enlightening system to your farm and everything on it. I think that speaks for itself in many ways, but.
Absolutely. And it's something that we really strive for, because with the dawning of social media and just kind of new age way of people understanding things about farming and food production or whatever, oftentimes it gets very glorified. It gets very rose colored glasses of, look at my cute calf, or look at the little chicks following the chicken around, or look at the bees pollinating the tomato flowers, or whatever it might be. But people always need to remember and realize, and weather extremes like the event we had last month remind people of this, is there's just as much death in that cycle as there is birth and rebirth and growth. And that death is very much part of that cycle. And without death and decay, you wouldn't have the bees, you wouldn't have the tomato blossoms, you wouldn't have all of these things that make it onto the Instagram post, right? Or whatever. And so we do our best to remember and reckon with that death is just a part of the cycle.
Even just taking it simply to the consumer, right? Like, you can't have that product, like your meats, or
without death.
But, I think that's the one thing, not making it about this, but people who are hard, vegetarians or vegans or whatever the case is, they say, I couldn't kill. And, people kill. It's like, how dare them? And it's like, from my experience of talking to people who've done this, like yourself, for a living, the amount of appreciation you have for those animals, most farmers and, hunters, whatever that may be, it's like, and their words, not mine, is like, there's like thanks and gratitude to the animal before that moment, or going up into that moment, which I think people, I don't know why, but they tend not to want to see.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a conversation I was having with a farmer the week of the ice and the snow. And I was explaining that, I lost two calves and I had to dispose of them, and disposing of them to us means taking them up into the woods and providing a meal for a coyote or providing a meal for a vulture or something like that. But what I said to him, and he reciprocated and said, I do the same thing, is when I took that dead calf up into the woods, I said sorry to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and somebody looking at that from afar, from a 40,000 foot view, might be like, well, why are you talking to a dead calf? But there's a energy there and a connection there that you did everything you could, but sometimes bad things happen. Sometimes death takes place, but having that interconnectedness to understand that, to say you're sorry. Mm-hmm. And conversely, when we take animals to the butcher, you know, we say thank you. We say thank you for the nourishment and the energy and the life giving that animal is giving to us and to people that will live on because of that animal.
Absolutely. And, you know, as much as we can go, I know we talked about last time, but you know, I would venture to say you're not getting that with your mass production sites. You know, you're not getting those experiences. And it's not to say that even the organics that you're seeing in mass production aren't having some benefits compared to maybe none, but just thinking, talking about energy and frequency, and you know, we said with the light and sun having its own power, the power of words and what that really is doing, right? Is you're giving thanks and you're saying, you know, giving your gratitude, you know, I can't speak exactly, but what is that doing to the animal, literally to the cells, to everything within it? You know, if it's like, you know, you're sending it off and you're like cursing it, you know, I mean, is that going to cause a different response? And we've seen this with studies with that Dr. Yamoto. I don't know if you saw with the water experiment. So there is validity to some extent to these things. Do we know all of it? I don't think so. But anything you want to add to that?
No, I mean, we don't know all of it and we never will. There is so much that goes on in the natural world that we will never, ever grasp. But having the knowledge and wherewithal to understand that there's so much going on is the first step in working together. And I can't stress that enough, that so much of agriculture and food production has become a fight for resources, a fight for this, a fight for that. And that energy ends up in your food. And so the more you can work together with natural cycles, with Mother Nature, with the sun, the better off your food is going to be. And then the better off your health is going
to
be.
Well, the key to what you just said there too, is when you're a part of the system, being in the system, we aren't separate from the system. We don't live outside of it. And I think that's part of one of the deceptions that we've experienced now, being a lot just consumers, you know, is knowing that the farming population has dropped drastically since the early 1900s, and that, you know, everyone's just, you know, consumer based, right? And what ends up happening is you're like, well, I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to see that. I don't want to know anything about it. I just want the food. I just get, take my money or take whatever, and I want that product. And I was in that mindset too, to some extent. Which is why it's been really beautiful and eye-opening for me to be able to try to really understand this more and more, and understanding that we really are a part of it. So what role do we play, right? What are we giving back to it? What's our gratitude or appreciation? So.
Absolutely. And it's something, you know, a lot of farmers won't name animals because of where that animal ends up. We don't explicitly name our animals, but all of our animals have identifying numbers to them. And we very openly and freely sit around the dinner table and talk about how 828 is providing dinner for us tonight. Right. Conversation at the dinner table tonight is what exactly happens in the butcher kill room. And that was a conversation with a 5 and a 7 year old little boy that asked the questions themselves. So they knew every step of the process up until that animal walks onto the kill floor, and they wanted to know what happens when that animal walks onto the kill floor. You know, probably not a conversation that's happening at every dinner table in America tonight, but something that those little boys will then take with them and complete that circle, that cycle of, they know every step of that animal's life. They know where it ends up. It ends up on our dinner plate. And they just wanted to know that one piece of that cycle. And understanding that things are cyclical is something that we've lost as a society, because like you said, we've removed ourselves from that cycle when in fact we can't really remove ourselves.
Right. Absolutely. So let's go into that. So being someone who's new, I don't understand, I've come to a farmer and I'm looking for local farmers. Is there a difference in the procedure, the process of, you know, killing the animal for food? Is there something that we as consumers should be looking for that are more, humane, I guess? Is there anything that you want to add or explain there?
Yeah, no, there's not major drastic differences in the way animals' lives end in America if they're in a butchering shop. I can't speak to what happens on, you know, farm A or farm B here and there, but there are certain standards in place in inspected butcher shops, whether it be for poultry or whether it be for cattle. But I guess where things do differ is the stress of that animal. Mm-hmm. So if you are in a feedlot and then go into a butcher where they're butchering 1,000 animals an hour, wow. Ultimately, those animals are smelling blood. They are hearing their cohorts meet their demise. And it's just everything shuttled through in a production model. Whereas the smaller you get into smaller butchers, local butchers, things like that, they take a little bit more, generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, they take a little bit more care to make sure that that animal is not stressed, is not experiencing the death of its cohorts, things like that. One of the most unique experiences we had, we don't raise goats anymore, but we did raise goats for a number of years, and we did halal butchering on our farm. And halal, for those listeners that are not familiar with the term, is basically a food cleanliness standard practiced by people of the Muslim faith that is very similar in a lot of ways to, I just blanked on it, kosher. Right. A lot of people have heard the term kosher. Right. And that is a food cleanliness standard for people that practice Judaism. Halal is very similar, but for the Muslim community. And so we would have people that practice halal butchering come out and butcher our goats on our farm. And the first time they came out, got everything ready, got the buckets of water, the ropes, the knives, everything, got it all set up. And these Arab gentlemen came out and I said, okay, well, I'm ready to go. Like, go ahead and do what you want to do. And there was a little bit of a disconnect and a lack of communication. And I only speak a very little amount of Arabic. And ultimately what they were trying to tell me was the goat herd could see what we were doing. They didn't want the goat herd to see their cohort meet its demise. And so they said, we can't start this until you take the goat herd somewhere else. And that was just a very eye-opening experience to me that they understood the importance of stress and of thanks and of that its cohort shouldn't see what was going on with it. And so that was kind of just one little eye-opening example of there are certain standards out there of stress that, you know, why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you move the herd away? Why wouldn't you afford them the respect? And ultimately, when it comes to mass production of animal food in our country, is we lose that sense of respect, right? When things get so big and so mechanized, we lose that inherent respect for the animal.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, just taking it a step further, right? Even the plants, you know, just because somebody doesn't eat meat doesn't mean, you know, that there weren't animals and there wasn't, you know, insects and there, you know, bunnies, mice, all these different things in those, you know, those vegetable fields that met their demise because of the mass, you know, the mass crop. Or the mass harvest that you know, some people are experiencing. And if you're buying mass production, right, it's like they might not be using, animal friendly, you know, harvests, you know, whatever machines or gadgets that they're using, You know, they might be cutting and dicing up a lot more than you would think. So it's, and that's also too, even just for the vegetables, right? We know that with mushrooms or fungus, there's this interconnective highway within the root system. So it's, you know, when there's disruption, right, they know there's a communication that occurs. There's specific plants that when they're disrupted, they put off different scents, different, you know, some poisonous. So it is a thing where it is alive. There's life to it. But when, as you said, when we look at it just as a commodity of this product, and lose sight of that, this came from something alive. And as we said, we're part of that system. It is really taking it a step further for a lot of people to go, wow, I'm, this is more than I'm allowing myself to give credit to, as you said, even with the goat herding. That's such a, I wasn't there, but I being a very visual person, I'm seeing that moment, and I can just experience for myself, like seeing the goat, seeing the expression, seeing just the whole kind of crescendo that's about to happen, and knowing you want to try to support their well-being, even though you know they're going to be killed here soon, but you're giving it that much more respect to go, I don't want this to be so jarring for you. You've done such a beautiful thing here. I don't want to make your last moments any worse than they have to be. I want you to end on that, as you said, that gratitude, thank you, love, whatever you want to call it.
Yep. Keeping that stress level low.
Absolutely. So kind of going back to some questions, you said the pests and weeds and how you deal with those things. What are some other questions that, you know, maybe people ask you, but then also just kind of a second question, what are some questions if someone's new that you think that they should be asking farmers in regards to just, you know, whatever beef, poultry, pigs, pork, whatever, whatever comes to mind.
Okay. Yeah. So on the animal production side of things, some of the main questions that are immediately asked are you using antibiotics? Are you using hormones of any kind? And what are those animals eating ultimately is the big question. And then a very simple holistic question of what are those animals eating? And more that food producer, that farmer can tell you, the more enlightened you're going to be to know that, you know, chickens probably shouldn't be eating ground up chickens, right? Pigs shouldn't be eating leftover chicken parts, you know, things that don't, I don't need to get super technical on you to let you know that if your gut doesn't think something's right, it probably isn't.
Right.
But ultimately when it comes to animals is, yeah, asking them what they're eating. What does their life look like is another big one. What does their life look like? Does their life look like they're in a cage their entire life, or they're in a building where they never see the light of day? Or does their life look like they get to roam around on grass all day and that's their life?
Yeah.
So
and to be kind of like the questions for dummies. So what would be a typical thing that you would expect a local farmer who's following, you know, proper techniques to be feeding chickens? Start with there.
Yeah. So a real easy one is chickens need some sort of grain source, right? They need an energy source. Chickens can eat grass and bugs, but they're not going to get enough energy from those grass and their bugs. So farmer inevitably is supplying some sort of grain source to provide energy for that chicken. And so questions that you can dive into with that are where does that grain source come from? Do you know where it comes from? Is it organic? Is it GMO free? That gets a little tricky and we could dive into that, but you know, where is that grain source coming from? What's in that? Do you know what's in that grain source? What's in that feed? Most chicken feed that you would buy at Tractor Supply or the co-op or whatever, there's so many things in it that you can't even pronounce. And I say that because I go back to Michael Pollan wrote a book about food rules here a numbers of years ago. And it's a real simple book, but it really spells things out of if you can't pronounce it, do you really want to be putting in your body? And just some really simple rules that I would definitely suggest you and or your listeners checking out. I think it's called Food Rules by Michael Pollan, who was the author of Omnivore's Dilemma and some of those other food books here in the recent past. But real simple food rules that just kind of make you think on a simplistic level of what are you putting in your body? And so if I can tell you, so for example, our chickens, right? They eat oats, corn, soybeans, and fish emulsion. Those are the four ingredients that are in the chicken feed. There's no monohydroxychlorophosphate, whatever.
Right.
It's oats, soybeans, it's corn. I mean, those are very simplistic things and we all know what they are.
Chicken or table scraps and things like that for them as well, or?
Absolutely. Yes. 100%. So I'm very proud to say that we are a no waste farm, meaning everything that we eat, everything that we dispose of, we literally have a 5-gallon bucket in our kitchen. And once a day it goes out and gets thrown out to the chickens. Chickens are omnivores, so they will eat meat as well as vegetables, as well as foodstuffs. They don't eat everything. They don't eat like citrus rinds and stuff like that. But of our food waste, they eat probably 95% of it.
Wow, that's awesome. And so we kind of follow through that. Obviously, we can go more there, but in regards to what people should be asking for feed, basically, what would be ideal for cows? If someone's saying, hey, what should a cow eat?
Cow should eat grass. I mean, it does not get simplistic than that. Cows eat grass. Cows have four stomachs and they're ruminants, which means they eat forages, they eat grasses, they eat legumes. So if a cow is eating anything other than grasses, that would be a little bit of a red flag to me. If they're eating grains, corn, soybeans, those things that I was talking about that the chickens eat, cows need that. Cows need water, sunshine, and grass.
Right.
That's really all they need.
Yeah.
It's really that simple.
Now, when you supplement it, I know people supplement it with hay. What's the reasons for that? Is that proper? Is that?
Yeah. So hay is all hay is dried grass, right? Yeah. So hay in its simplistic form is just grass that's been dried out and bundled up together. So yes, it is totally kosher. It is totally normal and practice. We feed hay on our farm because unless you live in a climate where you can feed your cows living grass year round, you have to supplement them with something. So what's better than living grass is dead grass, dried up. And that's what hay is. It's dried up dead grass.
Gotcha. Now, do you grow it yourself? Because I know that's something over here. When I was talking to the local farmer that I saw, they said that they were trying to start doing their own hay because market for hay has been crazy.
Market for hay has been crazy. That is 100% accurate statement. We have hayed some of our fields in the past. I'm trying to move away from it, honestly, because every time you hay your field, you're mining stuff out of that field, right? Mm-hmm. You're harvesting minerals, you're harvesting elements, and you're taking all that out. So unless you're putting it back onto your soil, you're basically taking something away, you're mining it out, you're harvesting it, and then you've got a deficit. So I have found that the more you can buy hay in, you're bringing in somebody else's minerals, somebody else's mm-hmm. elements, and applying it to your own fields. So we've done both, but in the grand scheme of things, we're trying to move towards purchasing in and bringing in somebody else's wealth. Right. Than mining out our own.
All right. No, yeah, I definitely see the logic behind that. I'm like, that actually makes a lot of sense. but staying, before we get to like pigs and stuff, staying on hay, one of the big things, obviously, I'm aware of this, but it's illegal here, is raw milk. People are so up in arms about raw milk. What are your thoughts on the raw milk? Its benefits, the downfalls, what are your points of view?
And this is all just personal opinion. I'll just preface with that. I think the health benefits of raw milk are something that is desperately needed in our society. I think when you take milk and you sterilize it, which is what we do on a mass scale, we sterilize that milk. We take all of the good microbes, all of the good living organisms, and we heat it up, right? And we sterilize it. What you're getting at the grocery store is not much more than colored water. And so in terms of the health benefits, in terms of the overall just benefit of raw milk, I'm 100% supporter. I think it's absolutely ludicrous that our government has gotten involved in raw milk and outlawing it in certain states. There are some of the goofiest laws out there in different states about raw milk, what you can do, what you can't do, where you can sell it, how you can sell it. It's absurd, frankly. And just milk as a commodity has become such an absurdity. I mean, if you go back not that long ago in America, in many, many communities, everybody had a milk cow, right? Everybody had a milk cow, a little flock of chickens, maybe butchered a hog or two every single year, and traded and shared and helped each other in the community. And we've moved so far away from that to now most cows that produce milk in America never see the light of day. They're in a confined operation indoors. They're not eating grass. They're not seeing sunshine. And they're producing this milk, which is nutrient lacking. And then any nutrients that are in it are then boiled off. And you end up with some, you know, white colored water that you get at the grocery store.
Yeah, man. And that's just the unfortunate thing. And I guess I'll ask, from your opinion, why is it that you think there's such an outlaw of raw milk with all this?
Because one in every 100,000 people will get sick and or possibly die from it. More people, our government wants to absolutely limit any extremities in terms of food safety, right? And they want to just take away any possibility of anyone getting sick or dying because they have taken themselves out of the cycle. They've removed themselves from the cycle. The mm-hmm. truth of the matter is, if we all in our entire country drank raw milk, yeah, somebody would get sick and somebody would die. But that happens on every community on the planet. And that's part of the natural cycles of life and death. And I know that can sound callous or whatever, mm-hmm. but the truth of the matter is there is so much more benefit to the health components of raw milk than there is detriment to the very, very few occasions where somebody might get sick from it.
Right. But this, it goes back to also, and I guess, yes, very well could be, obviously if you let milk sit in many ways, it could be unhealthy bacteria. Like there's no question about it. Right. Yep. There are certain components, but as I just said, there are other things definitely consider. Yes, it could just be something with what the cow was eating. It could be something with, you know, your health. Is there other underlying conditions? And it's not saying ignoring that, yes, someone might die because of the bacteria that's in the milk that did not sit. And obviously your body had a response. No question about it. But like you said, what are we seeing now? It's like, all right, well, we need to protect it. Well, we still allow cigarettes. We still allow, you know, all these pesticides and herbicides. So what is it really, is it really about safety is the question. It really is a genuine question, right?
And it's not. We still allow lettuce and spinach. Many, many more people in our country will get sick and or die from foodborne illnesses in lettuce and spinach than they ever will in milk. And yet lettuce and spinach is still mass produced on a scale that causes illness every year.
Right.
But the laws in place about that.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what's just so interesting. And it's not about getting angry or getting upset. It really is about going, okay, well, that doesn't make any sense to me logically. You know, say I am somebody now looking for a local farmer. It's like, oh, well, okay, if they are selling raw milk or there's ways to purchase it, really consider it. Really, you know, I think it is important to consider looking into it. As you said, most of us are very deficient in vitamins and minerals. So healthy bacteria is probiotics, things that you're going to find in goat's milk or, you know, cow's milk that are super nutritious.
We've sterilized our society in such a manner that everything is sterile and safe. And we've taken the life out of our food. We've taken the life out of things. I joke all the time that my kids inevitably at some point in their lives have probably eaten chicken poop, not because they pick up chicken poop and put it in their mouth, but because it is on their hands as they're cleaning the eggs or doing something like that. But because of that, they have stronger immune systems, right? They have stronger guts and microbiome in their gut that is helping them to fight off that really bad stuff, but is creating a living mechanism within their body that is able to fight off impurities and things that might make them sick.
Well, think about also what a lot of these impurities are, right? It's like, okay, just look at history. Farmers, this and that. Yes, many people might have been cleaning eggs and gotten chicken poop on their hands. Okay, this is a common thing. The body, in many ways, talking about being a part of this circle, knows that. It can understand that, being like, yes, I know this smell or this taste or whatever goes in the body. But now when you start looking at synthetic type of chemicals, these are man-made, a lot of them. What is that doing to the body? Does the body honestly know that, saying, hey, I know what that is? It doesn't. Comparatively speaking, it's a lot different. It's something that's being, you know, manifested and made in, you know, labs or this and that to go into these things, and your body's going, wait a minute. Yes, it's maybe.
How do I respond to that? Yeah.
How do I respond to that? So in many ways, a lot of what, and we see this with allergies, has been an increase, a huge increase in allergies. A lot of people, it's because of a lot of these added chemicals and additives and things into foods and formulas and stuff like that. It's, you know, there's a lot of research on that right now.
And it's, so to close the loop from a earlier point of our conversation. So yeah, allergies are through the roof. What is the number one thing you can eat or consume to help your allergies?
The food.
Local honey. Go find some honey that is produced local to where you live. That local honey will help you with your allergies 10 times better than any other pill or anything else you take out of a bottle.
Yeah. So I've been actually doing, we buy local, some local honey as well, but that was one of the things that I thought it was more of along the lines of like seasonal allergy type thing, but I didn't realize it was with allergies across the board.
Yeah. Honey is one of the most natural elixirs you can put in your body in terms of a healthy cleansing thing to help your body adapt to its environment.
Well, real kind of as quick side note, I'm allergic supposedly to bees. Like I've had like stings and like it like swelled my hand up and everything, and I had like an EpiPen and all these things. And for the longest time I was like, oh, bees. But when I actually like took a minute to research bees and try to understand bees, or just hearing people to like talking to beekeepers, I through that process learned such an appreciation for bees that I'm not like going around and like trying to get bees, but I'm like infatuated by how much they give and what they're doing. That goes into so many different levels of like their wings defying, you know, what we would consider, you know, gravity, all these different components, the energies that's off of them, their communications, understanding how there's a specific farmer who is talking about with a lot of the electromagnetic frequencies that we're experiencing. When bees go far away and there's a frequency that's disrupting, that's what's causing a lot of the issues with bees coming back to their hives, is because of the electromagnetic frequencies. So there's so many different things that you start to realize that bees are communicating and doing that are so powerful, that we just either ignore or we just had no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree. Could not agree more.
So yeah, man. But I don't want to keep you any too much longer, but let's talk just real quick. What are things that pigs should be eating?
Pigs are true omnivores. So pigs truly can be eating just about anything. When it comes to pigs, it's much more about their environment and where they're living than what they're eating. So pigs are rooting animals and they belong outside. They belong in a field or in the forest where they can root and act like pigs. Most pigs in America now are raised on concrete. Right? They don't get to act like a pig. They don't get to root for grubs and worms and things like that. So as it comes to pigs, the question to be asking is, where are those pigs being raised? Not so much what are they eating. Because pigs will eat anything, up to and including you, if push came to shove.
Well, I was gonna say, pigs, if you take an actual like a farm pig and let it go out into the wild, after a while, don't their like teeth, tusks or whatever, like grow into like almost like boars? Isn't it just like a natural process that occurs?
Yep.
Yeah, I remember hearing that and I was like, that's so fascinating. And it, you think about it, with any animal, like domesticated animal, in many ways, when you let them go, natural survival kicks in and, you know, their body adapts, right? Talk about being part of the system and understanding. And I could take, go down a whole rabbit hole there, but I don't want to take any more of your time. But last question, if anybody who is coming, who isn't asking certain questions, what would you leave people with in regards to like, hey, this is something maybe worth asking? I know we've talked about a little bit before, but, you know, I think one of the things we talked about, maybe I'm teeing you up here a little bit, is like, you know, ask them to go see your farm. Is that something, how would you go about that? Yeah.
Yeah. So ultimately, and this is a big word, but transparency is where it's at. So asking a farmer if they could come out and see the chickens, if they could come out and see the cows, if they could come out and see the vegetables, or partake in it. So many different things going on now, whether it's a farm to table dinner or whether it's a CSA day where people get to come out and interact on the farm, but really offering the opportunity for people to come out on the farm. If you as a consumer are asking to come out to the farm or to see different things or whatever, and you're getting any sort of hesitation or roadblocks from the farmer, that would be a red flag of,
hold on one sec. We got a little lag here. Hold on one second. Oh, I lost you there. Oh, hold on one sec. You're muted. Oh, there we go.
We good?
Yeah, we're good now. No worries. So where I lost you was ask them to see the farm. If they're hesitant, that's a big red flag.
Yeah. So anytime that a farmer doesn't want to show off what they do, that would raise some eyebrows to me. You know, farmers are very proud people as a whole and are very, for the most part, very welcoming and open to showing off what they do. So if you were to encounter somebody that's producing food that doesn't want to show off what they do, that would be suspect, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I I'm with you, man. And it's fun, man. At the end of the day, someone in my, I'll just say from my point of view, learning this, I know it can be intimidating and cause people to become timid sometimes, but it really becomes exhilarating just knowing that it's a chipping away thing. It's not about, you know, going to buy everything local right off the bat and having to figure it out today. It's really just a matter of, okay, let me start the process. Are there local farmers? What is their availability? Do they have farmer markets? And just, you know, yes, you're not go to the grocery stores, but having more of like an understanding of just simple, all right, hey, I know that there are other options. I know there's local farmers who maybe try to sell to these stores. Great. Let me go try to see the ones around. As you said, let me see if I can see their operation. And I can say from firsthand, when you finally get yourself back to, you know, as I plan to do, trying to grow as much as you possibly can and hopefully, you know, having chickens and things like that. The next best thing you can do is to get to know the local farmers, as you said, right? People come and it's not about just buying from you. It's about building community. It's about really connecting with you as well. And really kind of going through the ups and downs with you of, man, you know, I know that they lost some babies this last, or some calves this last week or whatever, but I'm with them. We're here. We appreciate everything they do. And that, you talking about how your animals are before they go to see their last day, in regards to good energy and good vibes, it's the same thing. I can only imagine the amount of love and support that you get when people are in that type of mindset.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, life's about relationships, relationships to the people in your community, relationships to your food, relationships to the people growing your food. And the more you can develop those relationships and really flush them out, the more full your life is. And that's no different with the farmer or the food that's being grown by that farmer.
Absolutely, man. Well, dude, I appreciate as always your time, man. This is always such a good time for me, just talking and learning so much. But I know you don't have much social media, but just for those who maybe are in kind of near your area that aren't aware of your setup, what is the best place to find you?
Yeah, www.ozarkpasturebeef.com. That's our cooperative of farmers, and we're highlighted in that, and we sell directly through that. So that's kind of our go-to.
Awesome, man. And I'll make sure to put that in the show notes, so anyone who might be in the area can go and find you. Me and my fiance have definitely talked about, like, we should just go there and see if
come visit, come show up,
just show up, man.
Yeah, just come on by.
That'd be awesome, man. Well, dude, thank you again for your time, and until next time, we'll see y'all later.
Awesome. Thanks, man. We appreciate it.